Michigan in Ann Arbor is the latest to be violently dismantled by police. And President Santa Ono claimed the peaceful action had become a threat to public safety. Dozens of officers dressed in riot gear, wielding batons, raided the encampment before dawn Tuesday, pepper spraying and pushing students to the ground as they tore down the camp. At least four people were arrested Tuesday, while two others were hospitalized after being pepper sprayed by police. Student protesters set up the encampment about a month ago, demanding the University of Michigan's endowment divest from companies with ties to Israel. This comes as the school's president, Santa Ono, is slated to appear before Congress tomorrow, alongside the presidents of UCLA and Yale, to testify about their responses to the student-led protests and how they're addressing reports of anti-Semitism on campus. For more, we're joined by Salma Hamami, Palestinian-American student at the University of Michigan, who just graduated earlier this month. Salma is the president of Students for Justice in Palestine chapter at the University of Michigan. On Tuesday morning, she was pepper-sprayed and beaten by police who raided the university pro-Palestine encampment. Joining us from Southfield, Michigan, welcome back to Democracy Now!, Salma. Can you describe what happened yesterday? And just to be clear, this has all happened after graduation at Mich?
Hi. Yes, it did all happen after graduation. Students at the encampment have been holding down the encampment long after, even after graduation. And at approximately 5:40 a.m., police came in full riot gear. Actually, while we were having a church service on the Diag, moving them out and essentially giving us a 10-minute warning saying that we must be cleared off of the encampment. However, that 10 minutes surprisingly turned into 5 minutes, and they immediately began to charge at the protesters and at the students with their batons and pepper spray. Nearly every step forward that they took, chemicals were being sprayed in every direction. As students were falling to the floor in agony and in pain, they continued to push forward, beating students with batons. And us standing, we were trying to, you know, hold up on to the students who have fallen down and lift them and take them over to safety. Yet they even began to arrest students in that very moment. So it was very difficult to keep track of who was being arrested because, you know, we unfortunately could not see in those moments due to the chemical attacks directly sprayed onto our eyes. And they constantly pushed us further and further back. It took them about half an hour to entirely remove us from the encampment as we tried our absolute hardest to remain strong and remain standing at the encampment. However, as we were pushed further and further back, students, unfortunately, were unable to remain standing due to the pepper spray and due to the intense beating with the batons as well. Students' phones were even confiscated as we were recording them. I personally, myself, was holding a megaphone and kept a reasonable distance from the cops as well as I was chanting, specifically emphasizing why I was there and why I was protesting at the encampment. I repeatedly said that my family has been killed and that is why I am here. And as I was saying that through the megaphone, police officers snatched the megaphone out from my hand and threw it behind them. So not only was it an attack on the encampment, but it was an attack on us as students protesting entirely. And it was quite a traumatic experience, to say the least, but unfortunately not one that was surprising at all. Given the response that the university has taken against student protesters within the last 8 months, this is not the first time that the university has unleashed violent police against students. And currently, as you mentioned, four are now facing felony charges. Three were actually hospitalized. And, you know, due to the inhaling of the pepper spray, several of us are unable to properly breathe at the moment due to the tactics that they deployed.
And Sam, I wanted to ask you, you mentioned that this repression didn't just start with the encampment. Many universities for months now have been cracking down on even the most minor protests occurring on their campuses. What's been happening in Michigan over the past 8 months?
Over the past 8 months, we have seen police brutally beat students to the floor, rip their hijabs off in the process, causing several students to have been hospitalized over the course of 8 months. We currently now have 8 total students facing felony charges and dozens more facing disciplinary repercussions by the university themselves. Even within the smallest protests of us marching into buildings during public open hours, we have been met with police violence, us protesting outside. We have been met with police violence. It seems that as though wherever we stand, the university refuses to engage in dialogue with us to discuss divestment, as we have been demanding for the last 8 months. And instead of meeting with us at the table and meeting with us at the encampment, they decided to meet us with violent force and chemical attacks.
Where do you go from here, Salma? You just graduated. You also helped to organize the protest at the University of Michigan graduation.
Yeah, so one of the reasons that the university decides to attack our encampment is because it is a physical display of our commitment, of our dedication, and of our motivation entirely. So by them thinking that they could take down the encampment, it is in no way ever going to take down our movement or our commitment, because that lies within the people and that lies within ourselves. And we are still standing. So regardless if we happen to have the tents laid up or we have an encampment or we have various forms of protest, it is always going to remain strong, and it is going to remain stronger than ever every single time the police try to oppress us, and especially when it is caused by our university. So graduates, alumni, staff members, faculty members, broader community members are all remaining united and are remaining united for the Palestinian cause and for the people of Gaza. And we are going to continue to fight back, and especially against these charges that have been placed against these students for protesting a genocide and for protesting our university's funding of a genocide. So we will remain strong, and we will remain wherever it is that the movement lies, because it lies within ourselves.
Do you think part of the dismantling of the encampment had to do with President Ono, president of the University of Michigan, having to testify before Congress tomorrow?
Absolutely. I think it is a tactic that they are trying to uphold to protect themselves. However, one thing that is going to be made evidently clear, as it has made evidently clear with every single other raid at the encampment, is that it is not a good look for the university to come in and send police in riot gear. Of course, it is a fear tactic that Congress is trying to put against these university presidents. However, again, it's not going to deter students away. And it is not a coincidence that around this time, President Ono is sending police officers to not only physically danger and harm students, but also hundreds of students be faced with disciplinary charges from the university themselves, and also 8 felony charges from the prosecutor's office.
Salma Hamami, we want to thank you for being with us, Palestinian-American student at the University of Michigan who just graduated earlier this month, one of the organizers of the protest at the graduation. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to New York, where the New School Gaza Solidarity Encampment has announced it's reached a deal with the university's Board of Trustees to hold a vote on divesting from Israel by June 14th. The agreement comes after months of campus protests by students and faculty demanding the new school divest its endowment from companies arming and supporting Israeli forces in Gaza and the West Bank. The agreement also granted amnesty to those involved in the peaceful protests. The New School Students for Justice in Palestine chapter has said the university currently has ties to several companies that are, quote, actively involved in and benefiting from the genocide in Palestine, unquote, including Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, Google, and Caterpillar. The New School has been home to the country's first faculty encampment. For more, we're joined by two guests. Alexandra Chasen is professor of Literary State Lang College at the New School. Professor Chasen was part of the faculty encampment and the negotiating team that led the Board of Trustees to agree on divestment. And Natasha Leonard joins us, a columnist for The Intercept. Her most recent piece is University Professors Are Losing Their Jobs Over New McCarthyism in Gaza. She's also Associate Director of the New School's Creative Publishing and Critical Journalism Master's Program. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's begin with Professor Chasen. You were part of the negotiating team. What happened? What did you agree to? It's fascinating to go down Fifth Avenue. On one side, you have the faculty encampment inside the New School. Diagonally across is Parsons. And straight across is the student encampment that was reestablished inside the school there.
So I'd like to begin by just establishing that this was a faculty-student collaborative effort. There were undergraduate students, graduate students, alumni, part-time faculty, and full-time faculty in both encampments and negotiating teams. And that's very important to us because faculty really wanted to stand in solidarity with students, so that collaboration is meaningful to us. I want to also say, of course, what this is not is an end to war or famine or occupation, and so we're keeping our eyes on the bigger picture, which is Palestine. We still have a lot of work to do. This isn't even divestment. It's a commitment by the Invest Committee to vote on divestment to zero, and that's an important point, on some language that I hope I'll be able to read to you in a moment. It's significant also because this represents movement on the part of the Investment Committee, movement in response to campus activism and to the expressed will of the representative bodies at the university, faculty and student senates, divisional bodies, unions, and the local AAUP chapter. The language, again, which I hope you'll let me read to you, we hope to be a model or at least to help organizers at other universities as well.
Yeah, and Professor, how does what's occurred at the New School differ, for instance, from the conciliation efforts at some other universities like Brown and Northwestern, the handful of university administrators that have actually attempted to negotiate with their faculty and students over divestment?
Yeah, well, we have achieved an actual commitment to vote, as Amy said, by or on June 14th, which is unusual. And this is what the investment committee will be voting on specifically. It's a call for complete divestment from industries implicated in military and police violence in Gaza and the West Bank, and all global militarized conflict, such as companies or subsidiaries involved in weapons manufacturing, military supplies and equipment, military communication, and public surveillance technology. And we believe that's really a step forward, and again, hope that it helps folks organize at other universities. Moreover, we, in exchange for this commitment to vote, in fact, for a public statement of the commitment to vote, we got, as was also mentioned, a legal, professional, and academic amnesty for all participants, and we agreed to disband peacefully, which we think is important. And moreover, if the committee votes negatively, we get a written statement of their rationale, which we also think will be a useful organizing tool.
And just the significance of the president of the New School is Donna Shalala, yes, a well-known name. She was the head of HHS, Health and Human Services, under President Clinton, a cabinet member. She was the president of Hunter. She was the president of the University of Wisconsin, the chancellor, president of the University of Miami. Her role in this?
It's been a journey, as they say. What she did on Sunday that was significant was that she turned over, she deputized a dean at NSSR to negotiate on her behalf and put that dean in direct contact with members of the investment committee, and that was a significant move.
So let's take this broader. Natasha Leonard is with us. She teaches at the New School, is also a columnist for The Intercept, where she has reported on how universities have been cutting ties with pro-Palestine faculty members without tenure, in addition to overseeing police repression sweeps of Gaza solidarity encampments. Your latest piece is headlined, "University Professors Are Losing Their Jobs Over New McCarthyism on Gaza." Lay out what you found.
Well, first of all, I want to say thank you for my colleague, Alexandra, and the extraordinary work that our Solidarity encampment and participants have been a part of. Zooming out, as you say, we've seen in the last 8 months such extraordinary repression from educational spaces and particularly universities. A lot of media attention has focused on the spectacle of encampments and the very, very brutal police response. But what you also have going on behind the scenes is the targeting of individuals who work at universities. And it's a very dangerous conjuncture because you're meeting this very specific politicized, anti-Palestinian, Islamophobic as well, repression under the misleading guise of anti-Semitism and fighting anti-Semitism. At the very same moment, we've had years of right-wing and neoliberal attacks on higher education per se. So educational laborers and academic workers are in more precarious positions as a starting point. And then you've got this condition set up wherein it's very easy to cut ties with academic workers. You add that right-wing agenda of undoing for ideological and profit-driven reasons safety for academic workers with the now, unfortunately, highly bipartisan agenda of challenging pro-Palestinian speech and silencing pro-Palestinian speakers. That comes together to a very dangerous constellation where you're seeing dozens of people facing job suspensions, people not having their contracts renewed, people facing disciplinary action within their professional circumstances and these kind of consequences that are overwhelmingly facing only pro-Palestinian speakers, not speakers who are supporting Israel's genocide. I spoke to a representative from the AAUP, the American Association of University Professors, who said that all of their cases are only related to pro-Palestinian speech.
Juan? I think Juan just lost the... Juan, go ahead.
We've lost
Juan. I thought we had him. We'll come back to him. If you can talk about the difference in how these universities, we just heard Salma Hamami just graduated from University of Michigan, the violent police crackdown, and what you see as the characteristics of the schools or the presidents who are not doing this and are setting up committees to negotiate, whether it's Middlebury or it's Brown or it's Evergreen State College.
I think what you see is a few outliers who are willing only by virtue, I would say, of the responding to steadfast protests, steadfast action taken by students who continue, and faculty members, who continue to bring back the focus to Gaza, to Palestinian struggle. That doesn't get lost. So it's only in response to steadfast action that you have some universities willing to negotiate at all. Across the board, what you're really seeing is all too much comfort with repression and retaliation and this new McCarthyism to a degree that I've not seen, both in terms of wildly disproportionate policing response to very, very kind of pacifist, peaceful campus protest, and a profound attack on academic freedom and academic speech, including extramural speech, which has been as policed as anything within the classroom.
And Natasha Leonard, you talk about some specific examples. For instance, Danny Shaw, who lost his position at John Jay College after 18 years as a professor of Latin American and Caribbean studies as a result of a campaign of right-wing pro-Israel harassment.
Yes, so Danny Shaw's case is one of over a dozen people I spoke to who have either been suspended or not had their precarious labor contracts renewed. We also, I spoke to Mohamed Abdul, who has been working for a year at Columbia, also teaching post-colonial studies, indigenous studies for 20 years. Jody Dean, who I believe maybe has been a guest on this show, a brilliant scholar who was suspended. She's tenured, so not lost her job, but is facing serious investigation for writing an essay outside of the classroom, what used to be understood as quite clearly protected extramural speech, drawing attention to occupation, genocide, and the Palestinian struggle. Again and again, the pattern is the same. You see public speech made and then targeted by pro-Zionist, pro-Israel groups, right-wing, often far-right doxing outlets, things like Campus Reform, antisemitism.org, and that then creates a backlash from within the university and indeed from politicians.
We just have 30 seconds. What's the role of the American Association of University Professors?
It is an organization that supports professors, but it really can't have a vast grasp on the expanse of retaliation going on here because it requires professors themselves to report a problem and require and ask for that case to be taken up. And so again and again, this retaliation is not being stopped in any sort of formal and official way.
We want to thank you both for being with us. Natasha Leonard, columnist for The Intercept, will link to your piece. University professors are losing their jobs over new McCarthyism on Gaza. She's associate director of the New School's Creative Publishing and Critical Journalism Master's Program. And I want to thank Alexandra Chasen, professor of literary studies at Lyon College at the New School, part of the faculty encampment and the negotiating team that led the New School Board of Trustees to agree to vote on divestment. This is Democracy Now. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Last week at the White House, President Biden unveiled steep tariff increases on various Chinese imports, including electric vehicles, which will quadruple from the current tariff rate of 25% to 100%. Biden spoke in a ceremony at the White House surrounded by union workers.
To make sure American workers and American business and corporations can compete and win in the industries of the future.
A spokesperson for the Chinese Ministry of Commerce responded, called the tariffs, quote, typical political manipulation. For more, we're joined by Kate Aronoff, staff writer at The New Republic, where her latest piece is headlined, 100% tariff on Chinese cars is a bad idea. She's the author of Overheated, How Capitalism Broke the Planet and How We Fight Back, and co-author of A Planet to Win, Why We Need a Green New Deal. Kate, welcome back to Democracy Now! Explain Biden's new position.
Great to be here. Yeah, I want to necessarily call this a new position so much as an extension of what we've seen as sort of an escalation of tensions by the Biden administration, really continuing on from the Trump administration. The tariffs that were put in place on Chinese-made EVs and maintained by Biden were put in place by Trump. And so what you see is a real attempt to balance a couple of different tensions, right? You have, on the one hand, the Biden administration's climate goals. You have, on the other, an upcoming election and the sort of real escalation of tensions on both sides of the aisle vis-a-vis China. And then you have these industrial policy goals, right? This idea that we need to revive our manufacturing sector that the United States needs to catch up. And so, you know, I don't think that's an easy balance to strike between all those things. But what you see, especially, I think it's important to keep in mind November here, is Biden really looking to lean into a really quite hawkish position on China.
I wanted to ask you, this Biden administration position that China is dumping on the rest of the world because of its overcapacity and in producing electric vehicles and solar panels. And I mean, that China has produced a $12,000 electric vehicle and the United States wants to double the what it would cost if it ever came into the United States. Isn't this like the opposite of globalization that the U.S. was trumpeting several years back?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of important things to unpack here. So you will hear Biden administration officials in particular use a couple of words that are a bit counterintuitive or just, you know, don't make necessarily sense to people who, you know, don't spend time thinking about trade policy. So this concept of overcapacity and dumping, right? So the idea here is that China has intentionally made too many manufactured goods that are, you know, outpacing the sort of domestic demand, and that they are intentionally sort of, quote unquote, dumping, as you said, these products onto the rest of the world, onto, in particular, the United States and the European Union. This is, you know, a real live debate among econ wonks, right? But it is also just sort of the basis of building an export sector, which is something that the United States does, something that economies all over the world do in the course of, you know, growing their economies, right? That is not sort of a strange thing to plan for, and we do it all the time, right? So, you know, I think I don't want to overstate the effect of these sanctions. We are importing very few Chinese goods as it is, and we, you know, have very few Chinese cars, EVs in particular. But, you know, there is this real tension, right? And that if the goal is to deploy clean energy and clean energy technologies as quickly as possible, including electric vehicles, you would theoretically want to have more of those available and more sort of affordable versions of those available. So, like I said, I do think there is a real tension here that Biden does need to strike, and I don't think it's necessarily wrong to want the U.S. auto sector to be competitive. But you know, there is this very, you know, big question I think hanging over all of this, which is if these tariffs are meant to protect the U.S. auto sector and protect the big three in particular, for GM and Stellantis, which have had a lot of trouble making competitive electric vehicles. What else is happening in order to do this? If you just insulate these companies from competition, that doesn't on its own mean that they are going to be able to compete with Chinese automakers, which have benefited from, you know, at this point, about a decade of really sort of concerted efforts to build up these sectors. There is real sort of industrial policy happening in China, some of which, you know, we don't want to replicate, and some of which, you know, is really something that is quite admirable in some respects. You know, I don't want to overstate that, but there is a real sort of fine line to be drawn between things that, you know, are genuinely quote-unquote unfair trade practices, as the Biden administration says, and things that are just ordinary industrial policy, which are worth taking a look at if we, you know, want to do something similar here.
We only have about 15 seconds, but what are you calling for instead of tariffs?
Just a real pragmatic collaboration of the kind that's already happening here, right? And so we have four GM, Stellantis are already entering into joint ventures on quite favorable terms with Chinese manufacturers who have a real sort of expertise around battery manufacturing, around critical minerals processing. More of that is not a bad thing, although there are, you know, bipartisan calls to ban even that sort of low-level collaboration, but just to not see this as zero-sum competition. We need to build a lot of clean technology. This is a very large pie, and there's no reason why the United States cannot also have a piece of it.
Kate Aronoff, we want to thank you for being with us from Mexico City, author and staff writer at The New Republic. We'll link to your piece, 100% tariff on Chinese cars is a bad idea. She's also author of A Planet to Win and Overheated. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
A Renaissance Coffee is open at SFU. Parminder and his team have been serving the SFU community with great coffee for more than 20 years. If you're looking for a wholesome meal, delectable desserts, or something to warm yourself and lift your spirits, Renaissance Cafe is the place to be, featuring fair trade espresso beverages and brewed coffee. Renaissance Coffee is open Monday to Friday from 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. Well, how do you get up and go?
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain.